Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And the big payback. Hey, man. Hey, the people are going to be mad, man. So, Sandy, let's Wall Street Journal article and today, and I was looking at this, and many of us, it says the Fed alone can't slay inflation. The money supply is only half the equation. Congress and the president needs to encourage innovation and productivity, which is what you were saying during the break.
Right.
That increasing chips and all.
Well, I mean, the inflation is caused by too much money chasing too few goods, right? I mean, there's the money is available to bid the price of things up because things are in finite supply
right.
And now things are in short supply. So we've taken the amount of money that we had in the economy, we've even reduced it some because we've increased interest and made it harder to borrow money. But that amount of money has been able to bid up the price of things because things have become so short in supply. So there's two ways to solve that problem. All that the Fed can do is to reduce the supply of money. Reducing the supply of money is hard on Tom, Dick, and Mary because you're basically trying to take money out of their hands so that they can't go to the grocery store and bid the price of groceries up. They can't go to the car dealer and bid the price of cars up because they don't have enough money to do it. So that's a very hard way in terms of creating hardship. It's a hardship-creating way to defeat inflation. The other side of it is to try and do the things necessary to solve for the shortages. And so getting more chips manufactured is one of the ways that you could solve for shortage. One of the reasons cars are in short supply is not because we're short on steel, but because we're short on chips. And, you know, we are a little short on steel, but there's shortages of truckers. There are shortages of all kinds of things. So if the government can begin to play an active role in trying to find ways to solve for the shortages, then you can solve for inflation without inflicting pain. In fact, you'll be inflicting benefit because by solving the shortages, you'll be putting more things into people's hands that they want. You'll be creating more jobs. You'll be potentially increasing wages without causing that wage money to be available to bid the price of things up because things are in plentiful supply.
Sandy, I'm trying to. There's something that sounds a little oxymoronish in that.
Moronish worries me. What does that mean?
Well, oxymoron.
I know.
Yeah, I know. But what it means is if you're saying that they are going to slow down the money and so people won't have the money that they need while they're replenishing all of the things that people need to purchase and buy, there's going to be a point there where the people themselves are going to have to, there's no way the people aren't going to have to suffer some
doing this.
No,
but I mean, the fact is that if you try to solve inflation totally by removing money from, taking money out of the hands of the people who are bidding things up in price because they're in short supply, then you're going to solve inflation totally with this painful solution.
Right.
Okay? But if you're going to solve inflation, on the other hand, you could solve inflation by totally ignoring the money side and just focus all your attention on the supply side and bring supplies up. The problem with that is it takes time. You know,
all of this is going to take time.
Well,
either way you go.
You can increase interest rates instantaneously. So that's a hammer,
right?
Okay? And you can use that hammer to strike quite rapidly. And so that's the reason why it can lead to recession because it is a hammer, and you're going to take money out of the hands of people quite rapidly, and you can have pretty immediate effects. It takes longer to solve the supply side, but if you spend lots of attention to the supply side. If the marketplace begins to believe that the supply side is going to be solved, then at least some of this inflationary psychology can be removed. Because you understand, both I explained deflation a couple of years ago. Inflation is a psychology, and the psychology is it's going to be more expensive tomorrow than it is today, so I'll buy it today so I can buy it cheaper than I can tomorrow. And everyone starts rushing to buy it today, which bids the price up today. Okay? If people don't believe that it's going to be more expensive tomorrow, they can relax about buying it today, and it'll take away from the inflation psychology. So if we do a twofold strategy, and if the marketplace believes it, that one, we're going to use the hammer to increase interest rates to take money out of your pocket. So don't spend it because it's going to be expensive to spend it. And two, we're going to make sure that we make sure that shortage goes away so that those cars and everything will be more plentiful tomorrow. If someone came and told you, you shouldn't buy that car today because it's going to be cheaper in 3 weeks, you'd wait 3 weeks.
Yeah, but so they're protecting the people from themselves. Is what that sounds
like.
Well,
no, they're protecting. It's a perfectly rational decision. This is not irrational. If you believe so strongly that you think you know that prices are going to go up in a month, you'll buy it today.
Right.
And that's a rational outcome. That's not irrational. You're not saving the people from themselves. They are facing a reality. And in some economies, in some places, in Argentina, Venezuela, Brazil, these places in South America that had runaway inflation, in Germany at the end of World War I when there was runaway inflation, it was a totally rational decision to take that wheelbarrow of money in and spend it today.
So, Sandy, rarely, if ever, is a president reelected during recession. Rarely, if ever.
Right.
So the people aren't going to see it as that these decisions that are being made right now while Joe Biden is president of the United States are going to be beneficial.
Well, we might have a recession. You know, it hasn't been declared formally by
this panel.
I know, yeah, but but if we do have a recession, if we are experiencing a recession right now, I will say that it's quite a mild recession because unemployment has not gone up, right? We still have full employment. The kinds of recessions that hurt elections are the kinds of recessions in which people are sitting on the sideline jobless. You know, we do have inflation, okay, and people are getting hurt by the inflation. And is that going to be enough pain that it will cause them to vote in some particular way? We'll find out. But so far, we've got an inflation without a serious inflation. So instead of having stagflation, we seem to be having the opposite of stagflation.
So Sandy, it could it be? And you are right. I don't. Whenever there was recession during my lifespan, when I understood what it was, people were laid off.
Yeah.
You're right. There's no comparison with that whatsoever. And so the inflation part of it, we've experienced that before. But when inflation was running rampant with Jimmy Carter, people were laid off too.
Right.
So
right now we don't have layoffs, and I think part of what the Wall Street Journal
can that continue? Or is that going?
Well,
are
no,
we
I
early
mean,
in this?
That's what they're worried about in terms of using the Federal Reserve as the only tool, because ultimately, when you use interest rates to the max to actually hit this thing over the head, you will start.
The companies aren't going to invest the money, right?
Well, yeah, you're going to start having layoffs, and you're going to start having retraction in the activity. Right now, we have a slight reduction in activity, but most people look at that reduction and blame shortage. So they'll say, okay, we aren't producing as many cars today as we were last year, but it's not for want of demand for cars. It's because we don't have the parts to build the cars. And so right now we still have pent-up demand. And we have pent-up demand for cars, and we have other pent-up demand, which is a little bit like what happens during a war, okay? During World War II, we had ration books, and we had restrictions on all kinds of things. We didn't build cars during World War II. There was a lot of pent-up demand for cars at the end of World War II. And in a way, while we haven't stopped building cars, we've slowed down building cars involuntarily because of the shortage.
So I do remember, and contrary to popular belief, I don't remember the recessions during World War II, but I do remember those that happened, you know, in the 80s and in the 70s. And I do remember that the auto industry would come to a complete halt. The housing industry would come to a complete halt.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, they're still tinkering around the edges. The auto industry is still moving. People haven't had those things. And then, Sandy, we'll move on, but you just know it's none of these things are going to happen in getting out of this. The inflation part of this isn't going to die overnight.
Well, I mean, you know, happily, I read those Wall Street Journal articles and The Economist and some other of the commentaries that look at financial information, and it did give me some hope with respect to how we could get out of this recession, because it is unique. The broad scale shortages we have right now are really what has driven inflation. It's created this pent-up demand, which has caused people on the sideline, people in the marketplace, to bid up the price. And shortage can cause a rise in price that's very rapid, and that's what we're seeing. And if we could solve the shortage problem, or if the marketplace believed that the shortage problem was going to be solved very quickly, and we were hot on the trail of solving the shortage problem, you would at least get rid of a lot of the inflationary psychology.
All right. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Monday. That's Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Show that'll wake you up. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, I wanted to talk about how many different wonders of the world are there? Nine, or are there more that we haven't counted?
Seven, I think, isn't it?
Seven. I thought there was.
I don't know.
I don't know. But anyway, this was supposed to be the eighth or the ninth Foxconn. And Sandy, is it safe to say right now it's been a boondoggle?
Well, it's definitely been a failure, and it was definitely a foolish thing from the get go to put that amount of money into a new technology type of business, a business that rides technology crests, ebbs and flows. And particularly a company like Foxconn that had a record of promised developments that didn't occur. We put a record We made a record commitment to them. I don't think we haven't put that amount of money into it yet, because happily the deal wasn't so badly drawn that we put all the money forward. But these local municipalities that built a bunch of infrastructure are really hanging out there and exposed, because they spent a lot of money to put in sewer and water and all kinds of stuff for a huge development that was going to create massive tax revenues for them. And, yeah, nothing's come of it.
You know, 13,000 jobs. It's like yesterday, man. Rance Priebus, Scott Walker, Donald Trump, Paul Ryan. You know, they were with their little shovels, and it was the biggest deal, right?
Yeah.
And those people were forced to sell their homes. They uprooted communities. They did all these different things, Sandy, and nobody could say that it's not nice to have those great roads, right? And the sewer and all those things. There are generations that will come after us who will be thankful that all that stuff is taken care of.
Remember when it was being built and it was like the future was upon us? They were building a new lane for I-43 that would be for autonomous trucks and autonomous vehicles that wouldn't have drivers, that would be going to and from to and from the Foxconn facility, traveling down from the city of Milwaukee, bringing workers who were hard pressed to find jobs in Milwaukee to their jobs down in Mount Pleasant. It was the future.
It was.
You know what? It was too good to be true. It was too good to be true.
You know, I remember when they were building that stretch of road. And it was suicide to drive it while they were developing that. I hated driving that road. And so many people died because they were doing all the construction.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're on it today, you say, wow, this is great road, right? But, man, all of that. And then you look at it now, and they won't even tell you what's being built there. They won't even let the media in to see what it is, Sandy. I don't know. I mean, there's nothing they can do to sue Foxconn, or
no, I didn't draw up the contract. I'm proud to say that, and I had nothing to do with it, and I haven't read it either. I suspect at least massive portions of it are public. I'm sure also massive portions of it have been redacted as being trade secret or otherwise necessarily kept secret. But it clearly was not a very favorable contract for Wisconsin. It wasn't a totally foolish arrangement. I mean, we didn't spend all of the billions of dollars up front, but there have been hundreds of millions of dollars spent in pursuit of and in preparation for, including all this highway construction. So the money that Mount Pleasant has spent, you said, I think you have that number. What?
Yeah, $167 million.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money for a little.
That's just the tip of the iceberg. Well, the state of Wisconsin had to fund that freeway bill extension and reconstruction. That wasn't cheap. You know, freeway construction costs quite a fortune per mile. We're willing to spend all that money for freeways, but we weren't willing to spend $7 million a year deficit for the high speed rail that would have opened doors from all the way from Chicago to Madison. We were going to have a high-speed rail train from Milwaukee to Madison. Wouldn't that have made a difference? But apparently that was going to maybe, worst case, be a $7 million a year operating deficit, and we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the Foxconn fiasco.
You know, Sandy, just the thought, and I never will forget it, because the old A.O. Smith site, where I worked for 34 years, was the site that they were going to build the high-speed rail.
Yeah.
And they were going to begin in a building that I started in at 18 years of age. I never will forget. I got a chance to come in that building when it looked like all these things were going to happen. and I saw a guy, a young man who was 18 years old, the same age I was. He was in the same building I was in, and all of a sudden his new life was happening. And Scott Walker cut it off.
Well, and you know, it was going to employ the same demographic that A.O. Smith had employed.
Right, right.
It would have been a massive shot in the arm for Milwaukee's employment during that period of train construction. And the train itself was going to be a massive shot in the arm for the economy of Wisconsin. The high-speed rail from Milwaukee to Madison would have been a game-changer in many ways. It would have brought lots of the magnet. You know, there's a lot of magic going on in Madison that would have become a part of Milwaukee, and a lot of Milwaukee's capability would have become a part of Madison. It was going to be very synergistic, as they say, if, you know, where both sides win in that kind of a deal. And, no, we had to kill that. But meanwhile, we were hatching the fiasco of all time, just about the Foxconn deal to basically bring all kinds of value to Wisconsin. Really, what it was designed to do was to create a huge headline for Governor Walker.
And you know, Sandy, the worst part about all of it is it's been off the radar. You know, it rarely does it come up. And I think that's the part of this that frustrates most. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams and apparently Jackie Wilson, too. So, Sandy, Joe Biden wants an industrial renaissance. He can't do it without immigration reform. Intel planned microchip plant outside Columbus, Ohio is the administration's poster child for reviving high-tech manufacturing, but failure to allow a small number of foreign-born doctorates to stay in the U.S. could cause the effort to fizzle. Johnstown, Ohio, just 15 minutes outside of downtown Columbus, the suburbs abruptly evaporate. Past a bizarre mix of soybean fields, sprawling office parks, and lonely clapboard churches. Let me just get to the crux of it, Sandy. We keep hearing everybody talking about bringing back the jobs, bringing back the jobs that made the middle class in this country, Democrats and Republicans. They're not bringing those. Those corporations aren't coming. Donald Trump claimed that he was going to bring them back. Remember?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
How many did he bring back?
Well, not too very many. I think the one thing about this article that might have some validity is Intel, which is a chip maker, and with this new legislation that's passed, there's $52 billion worth of government support and grants that are going to be fed into the chip industry for them to construct facilities in the United States to construct chips. So to the extent that the government feeds a bunch of money into a sector that makes it, in fact, cheaper for them to have a manufacturing plant in the United States, and in a circumstance in which with the productivity of a chip facilities, the differential in wage, the wage structure won't make as much difference, or at least it won't outweigh the benefits that are derived from the grants they'll get from the federal government, then yes, it's realistic to think that there will be plenty of jobs made in the chip sector to fill out the factories that will be built as a result of the $52 billion of aid. Now, $52 billion, you know, we were just talking about Mount Pleasant. Yeah. That was, what, $3 billion of Wisconsin. So $3 billion, you know, whatever that is, a portion of 52. 52 isn't such a huge number, but it definitely will support providing incentives for a number of chip manufacturing facilities in the United States and those jobs. But that's not the stuff that an industrial renaissance is made out of. That's right. The stuff that a revival of the chip industry is made out of in the United States. And, you know, there's that $52 billion is part of $250 billion.
Right.
And some of that other $250 is probably aimed at other kinds of incentives for other kinds of manufacturing in the United States. Yes, with government incentives, it should be possible to create manufacturing in the United States that would be competitive with the decision, would create a competitive decision for a U.S. company as compared to building that same plant in India or China. And the main difference is the productivity in the plant in the United States sufficient to mean that the wage labor differential that exists between U.S. labor and Indian labor or Chinese labor does not cause the decision to have you move that plant to India or China because of the cost of transportation and what have you. But as you made the point off the air, some of these decisions to build plants in China and India and elsewhere is because those are huge markets. And you're building a motorcycle plant in India because you're going to sell one heck of a lot of motorcycles in India.
Right.
So,
yeah, so I mean, all those things, to constantly hear people talking about, you know, the fact that these, you know, the renaissance in industry in this country, and going back to the glory years, that's never going to happen again because of technology. And you look at the plants that they built, Amazon and those major plants that you see as you come down 43 and you see those plants, and when they went up, you thought, oh, there are going to be a lot of people in there.
Well, you know, those plants are really warehouses with automated warehouse facilities.
Right.
They're not plants. I mean, you can look at the German economy. Germany, what is it, 65 million people. It's a fraction of the United States, maybe a fifth in size. But it has a very vibrant economy, and it is a manufacturing economy, and it is premised on manufacturing the kinds of goods in which the cost of labor is not the most fundamental element of the cost for the product. And furthermore, the nature of the product means that it has a great deal of value attached to it that drives the price. So Germany has a very vibrant manufacturing economy. The United States could generate an economy that has far more legs to it. The problem with the U.S. economy today is that it's basically this service economy. You know, Amazon doesn't make things in the United States. It stores things in the United States, and it delivers things in the United States, and it extracts money from the U.S. economy for the profit of Amazon, but it isn't the kind of business that that is the basis for an industrial renaissance.
So, Sandy, as we head towards the future,
mm-hmm. Generac, we have companies in Milwaukee that are the kind of companies, Generac, Milwaukee Tool. There are a bunch of companies that are the type of companies that can manufacture in the United States and do manufacture in the United States and aren't particularly compelled to move their manufacturing plants elsewhere because of the overall value that's added to the process through manufacturing.
But Sandy, those are the exceptions, not the rule anymore. And the major manufacturing I think that people are looking for is parts of that manufacturing all over the nation where you can then lift up the people's standards of living. That's not coming back from what you can see, is it?
It really depends on the nature of the operation. You know, you go to Stuttgart, Germany, and you go to Germany, and you can travel around, and it's filled with manufacturing plants, Bosch, Siemens, these companies you and I can name that are continuing to manufacture in Germany because of the nature of what they make and the nature of how they make it. The United States has the potential, but we've got to stop basing our business model on minimum wage workers. Minimum wage workers are not high tech workers. Minimum wage workers are not highly trained workers by definition. And so, you know, we've gotten away from what, and maybe it was because the kind of workers we had at A. O. Smith, for instance, was not high tech labor, nor it was highly trained labor, but it was mass construction. The old industrial model, the Henry Ford kind of model.
So let's bring David from Mequon in. Hey, good morning, David. You say what?
Hey, good morning, Earl. Good morning, Sandy. Really quickly, in regards with Amazon, I do agree with Sandy that obviously it's obviously more of a service industry. However, I will say this with Amazon, they are willing to use new technologies that do have an impact, though, across the board as far as, you know, they are been using robots and automation and what have you. And there are companies that do make that in the United States that will transcend. When you look at the industrial sector, automation and artificial intelligence is definitely going to be more prevalent in the near future here. And the United States, really, people don't realize when you build a house in the United States, most of those components are manufactured in the United States. Carpeting, flooring, roofing, the wood and what have you, the cement, asphalt. There's a lot of different things that are still made here. The difference is the trinkety stuff that people buy at like Walmart and Dollar Tree and stuff, that's obviously made in China. But the bigger stuff is still predominantly made here. Not to the levels like it used to be, okay. Boating, cars, RVs, all that stuff there's still quite a bit that's still made here.
Well, no, there's no question about it. But there are lots of things that are made in the United States. The question is whether we can get ahead of them. For instance, artificial intelligence. China's ahead of America in terms of its development of the capacity for artificial intelligence, and so the United States economy. We need to make sure that the business models of our businesses are looking forward. Happily, that's part of the benefit of the market economy, is that businesses tend to be forward-looking and worry about where they should put their investments.
So, David, hang on a second. We've got to go to a break. It's okay. Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Different kind of guy. Okay. All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. They got David from Mequon on the line. You know, David, nobody's questioning whether or not there's still some manufacturing companies in this country. We're talking about major manufacturers that can lift people up out of poverty and what was once there. And yet there are people who keep talking as if both Democrat and Republicans that renaissance is going to come back in this country. And as I was talking with Sandy, no, those things aren't ever coming back here.
Well, my disagreement, I guess I'm leaping in here, David, but my sense is that there is an opportunity for it to come back, but one of the problems we have is that the way our government operates in terms of providing incentives, and primarily tax incentives, most of those tax incentives are not designed or really intended to create future-looking things. They're basically designed to deal with the status quo and to reward status quo. So we have, you know, we provide support to the corn industry. We provide support to the oil and gas and coal industries through depletion allowances, et cetera. And we really aren't doing much in the way of supporting things like artificial intelligence or the research and development that relates to that in terms of the way the government provides incentives. You know, we have now just recently passed some legislation to put a bunch of money into it, which incidentally is exactly the way China supports its industry. So for all of our jumping up and down and arguing that the foul play in China, what we've realized is that in order to get the market-based economy to look forward sufficiently, if we've got government intent behind it, is to put money into it.
I would agree with that sentiment from the standpoint that, yes, I do think there has to be more forward-thinking as far as what you're speaking about, the artificial intelligence and robotics I would put in there as well. I would say this. The United States, the one thing I will say is this. One of the reasons why, though, we're having trouble getting people to get into manufacturing is, and this is just my personal opinion and through friends, but most of the kids today are told not to go into, manufacturing or things of that nature. It's kind of downplayed. Going to a technical college where, you could, and that's where they are in huge demand. I mean, if you drive north of here, every single place manufacturers dying for workers. And unfortunately, the younger generation is not compelled to do that. And they do pay much better wages than what you would do in a retail environment by far. And so I do think there has to be a change a narrative with that as well, because to your point, the service economy is not going to pay as well if you're producing something. Producing something, yes.
So Dave, let me just say this: you can drive around, Waukesha and other places, and where they're manufacturers and these smaller shops. And they are all looking for signs up, looking for help. Well, yes. The help is back in Milwaukee. And so because many people who live in these areas, their children aren't going to be working in those factories. And I've never understood, why we can't make the connection. Every person that lives in the city of Milwaukee is not unqualified to do that kind of work. We've got to get back to where the workers are and make sure that they can get out to where the jobs are.
I think we're at the chicken and egg discussion.
Yeah, that's where we are.
I know, and I think David has identified something. There is a chicken and egg problem. There are now a bunch of jobs, and we've got to find a way to communicate to the people who are will be emerging into the job market. I mean, a person who should be going to a trade school isn't yet in the job market, but will be shortly, and they need to start having a planning horizon and a view of the future that accommodates going to technical schools. And places like Germany do a far better job of providing guidance to young people, and the young people see a much clearer pathway. But you've identified something, but I think in many respects, because it's something that needs to happen and the marketplace doesn't seem to be accomplishing it, it's something the government needs to somehow intervene and work on. And so I would hope that conservatives in conservative politicians as well as liberals would decide that a proper role of government here is to do some things to solve chicken and egg, to help young people realize the potential value of moving in the direction of trade training, and to and so, you know, maybe this is something where conservatives and liberals can reach agreement, because I'm sure liberals agree with this, and and I think conservatives would too. But right now, there's very little government. There's very little government programmatics to accomplish it. And this is an area where money spent by the government could be very productive.
You know, Sandy, these 200 boys that we have Monday through Friday set up a plan for them to go to a guy who has a construction site. These are boys 10 to 15 years old. And they have gone to this construction site, and they see what is going on, and they're young enough, 10 to 15 years old, and this is the reason why I wanted them to go there. They got to see firsthand and tinker around with some things that now they've seen a construction site.
You know what? Yes, it's interesting to me. You know, you try and have something done to your heating system in your house, and every heating, ventilating, air conditioning contractor is short of workers. You try and have some landscaping done, and they're short of workers. Everybody is short of workers, and somehow government, society, whatever we want to talk about, has to figure out a way to make the connection between this need for workers and the people who need work. And plenty of those people who need work need some interim training in order to qualify themselves for work. Some of that training is just learning work ethic,
right,
that permits them to be reliable and workers. And then beyond that, and you're doing that right now, Earl, with your wonderful program with these young kids. You're starting them on the path of learning the discipline, learning both the opportunity and the potential discipline and the reward. You know, you're giving them money. They have to show up. They've got to be reliable. But we've got to get to work on this. And I suspect the solution wouldn't take as long as we think if Dave and you and I and all these other people would get together with this notion of let's get all these jobs filled with all these people who need work. And let's figure out the reasons that why they aren't working, and let's solve for that.
Yeah, you know, to me, what we used to have was a way to marriage the people who needed work with the jobs, and they had a system set up, the unemployment departments.
Well,
they had,
there was another thing, too, quite frankly, which I know, Dave, but unions used to recruit people into the unions, and then they would get into the training programs
with
the unions.
Yes.
And so the trade unions actually recruited people in small towns and large towns. They identified the jobs. They did a lot of
stuff.
That's
how it happened.
And that was all grown out of the guilds that had existed after the feudal system. So, you know, we've kind of lost track of all that. And now we've got this problem. We need to solve it.
Dave? All right. Okay. You know, Sandy, all of it is a constant reminder of what we were. And we have to go back to what we were in order to find out what we need to do, right? I mean, what's wrong with looking back?
Well, we can look back and see things that might be things that worked, or at least were working, and figure out how we replace them with new things that will work. I don't want to go back, and I don't want to do the MAGA thing.
No, right.
Because America wasn't great in every way in the past, but there were elements of America that were fulfilling important functions, which we got rid of, and we haven't replaced those with effective functions. And one of the ones is the one that Dave identified, which is ways to find those young people who could have magnificently fine careers doing things that are not the result of a college education, but the result of trades, for instance, and training.
You know, there's no question, Sandy, whatsoever, that those types of things are necessary, and we need everybody working together on that. I would agree. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. You're tuned in.